So I have a short introduction before I give you the longer introduction, okay? Yeah. So first of all, I want to really thank you. Louder. I keep saying that I'm only used to shouting at my husband, but okay, I'll do my best, okay? He's here. So first of all, I really want to thank you for inviting me. I'm really honored to be here. It's been a very long and, it's been a very long and overwhelming year, and it's not over yet. Even louder? Okay. And I also want to apologize. I'm used to teaching, to have a course which lasts a whole semester. So I asked my husband to give me a little sign 17 minutes into the lecture, because otherwise we're going to stay here forever. I have a lot to tell you about what we are still doing in Israel, but we can only touch just a few of the points. Okay, louder. Okay, sorry. Now. Okay, here. Okay. Sorry. Usually I speak very fast. I never got any remarks about not being loud enough. Okay. I want to start with the definition of trauma. Okay. The most famous definition of trauma is being taken from Greek, from ancient Greek, and it means a wound. Hence, we can use it in medicine and also in psychology. But I think it's a very narrow definition, and I prefer much better the definition of Janov Bulman. She's a researcher, and she was not the only one to define trauma as followed, but it's a good definition. Trauma is the shattering of our basic assumptions. Okay, as long as an event doesn't shatter our most basic assumptions, it will not be traumatic. Our basic assumptions have to do with justice, with trust, and with order. Probably some more things, but these are like the three most important assumptions. And usually when we come into the world, the assumption is that we have these ideas about how life is going to progress. And it's only when we encounter a reality that is too different than what we expect it to be that it may become traumatic. I promised everyone I'm not going to be too political, but I do want to say that the Israeli societies, at least for many of us, our assumptions were actually shattered 10 months before October 7th, because some of the most basic assumptions that the Israeli society believed in were, let's say, challenged by our government. For some of us it was shattered, but for others it was just challenged. And October 7th, which was 10 months into the government reform, I think many of us, and of course many of the survivors, because most of the people who survived the massacre live in kibbutzim and are not the biggest supporters of the government, so many of them got to October 7th with issues of trusting the state, of feeling that they were abandoned or deserted by the public agencies or by the political agencies. But I do have to say, we have never ever expected anything like October 7th. And I'm saying that because some of us who were fighting in the streets actually thought that there is going to be a big war. But we never imagined this kind of issue. The second thing that I want to say, just in short, is to make the distinction between PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a psychiatrist diagnosis, and post-trauma or post-traumatic effects. It's not the same. PTSD is a disorder of anxiety and depression. And the big difference between anxiety and depression and PTSD is that people with PTSD have to be able to remember or recall an event which they perceived to be dangerous for their life or for the wholeness of their body. But post-trauma effects can be much, much more varied. I mean, almost everything can be a post-traumatic effect. It can be eating disorder, sleep disorders, feeling moody but not necessarily depressed, having difficulties to concentrate, and more. I think that very often when psychiatrists diagnose someone with PTSD, they basically refer to a pile of symptoms, which can be very difficult, but it's symptoms. As a clinician, I refer more to the person's ability to have a full life, to be happy, to be able to enjoy relationship in addition to all the kind, to all the symptoms. And now I recall that I didn't introduce myself. I plan to. Yeah, sorry. Let's go back. And you will see soon that this is all about trauma. Trauma is almost never about the present. You keep going back and forth from the past to the future. So you can have the experience with the way I talk about trauma. So I'm a professor at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and my expertise is actually in complex trauma, which has to do with traumatic events that take place within an intimate relationship or within a relationship that has to do with dependence and trust. I'm also a social worker. Like, I haven't done much social working, but I'm a social worker, and I'm a training psychoanalyst, which means that I believe in long-term therapies. We usually talk about the patient's mother. I'm sorry, I'm a mother, and I know my children talk about me in their therapy. We are responsible for everything, sorry. For better and worse, by the way. And that's also a big issue when we talk about trauma, because the state all over the world, countries prefer short-term CBT style therapy for trauma. And that's possibly the only way to have an academic career, by the way. It's very difficult to have a career when you're a psychoanalyst, because it takes 10 years for a person to finish his therapy, at least 10 years. And it's an art, so no therapy is exactly the same like the other. So it's a bit easier with CBT, and it's also very important to be familiar with CBT. But when we talk about the person's ability to live a full life emotionally and psychologically, we usually need models which are more complex than short-term therapy. I want to take you through a very stormy journey of what I've been through from on October 7th and on. And of course, there are hundreds and hundreds therapists like me, but I will just give you, I hope, an idea of what kind of patients we are treating and why it is so difficult to apply the therapy that we are familiar with to this kind of traumas. So first of all, I have to say that I was heading an organization during the protest, and it was the only protest organization which was made up of professionals. Hundreds of physicians and hundreds of mental health professionals, and we were responsible for treating the people who were wounded by the police on the streets. Personally, I was responsible to support these people once they were evacuated to the hospital. Of course, not just by myself. I had a group of volunteers, but I've spent endless nights in ERs all over Israel. And I'm saying that because as painful as the situation is, and it is very painful, the Israeli people are also very, very strong, and they really rose to the occasion. Okay, it was the most of the facilities that we established on October 7th for the survivors were established by protest organization. We had all the facilities, and we were there on the spot. So October 7th, like it was supposed to be a quiet Saturday. So basically between 2:29 a.m. to 6:45, depends where you live in Israel, we all woke up with the wailing sounds of the sirens. I have to say, we didn't even bother to get out of bed. We don't have a shelter in our house. We have to run to the end of the street. We said, oh, it's just the usual. We're going to stay in bed. It was Saturday. But it took us about an hour to understand that something very unusual was going on. And so by 8:30 or so, we had a meeting of the board of the organization. And we decided that we are going to redirect everything that we have to the people who are going through something in the South. Again, we had no idea what it was. So the first few hours, it was basically the physicians who took center stage. They talked with people who were locked up in the shelters, in the kibbutzim, in the South, and helped them to, gave them advice how to dress their gunshots. And they helped Mada to evacuate people to the hospitals. And some of them just got into their cars and went down south to help save lives. In the next few weeks, they did their best to import medical aid from basically from the United States, because there weren't enough equipments for the hospitals. Basically, we donated that to the army. And my job began at about 2 p.m. I got a call from one of my friends on the board, and she said, look, I have a good friend. His name is Danny, and he lost touch with his son. His son, we'll call him Tom. You don't have to worry about the details. I'm changing it so nobody can be identified, but the stories are completely true. So Tom, she told me, Tom is 38 years old. He's married and he has two very young children. And he went bicycle riding at the South. And on 6:45, he called his wife and he said, there's a big mess, but I'm in the car and I'm on my way home. On 9:30, after endless attempts of his mother to reach out, to reach him, someone answered the phone and shouted in Arabic, mot, 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 which is paradoxically enough, it's identical to the Hebrew word of die, die, die. So the father told me, I know for sure that my son is either murdered or has been kidnapped to Gaza. By 2:00, we already knew that some people were kidnapped. And he said he's a very tough cookie. So he told me, look, I'm completely okay. You don't have to worry about me, but please go and see my daughter-in-law and her two children. So I got into the car and drove about an hour and a half away from where I live. And I met the wife and the two children, and I spent out some time with them. And for the next few weeks, I was with them on and off. And I think it was about 2 or 3 days after October 7th that Tom's body was identified. And I had to break the news to his children. And I can still remember, and I don't think I'll forget it, the day that I died, that we were sitting on the floor, and his daughter is 5 years old. She was 5 years old, and I had to tell her, and that was the first time I ever had to do that. And it's called in Hebrew a bitter announcement, like when you tell someone that their loved ones are dead, and I had to tell her that her father is dead and that he is never going to be back, and she was quiet. She's a beautiful girl. And then she looked up at me. And after a few moments, I still have shivers when I tell this story. She started screaming, I want my daddy back. I want my daddy back. Okay, I was trying to grasp my breath. And when I left their home, there was yet another missile attack. And I was just weeping all the way back home. I mean, it was horrible. At 10:30 p.m., I received a phone call. I never ever answer my phone because I'm always working. But the name on the screen was one of our best friends. So I answered the phone, and he was shaking. And he said, "Look, I'm just coming back from Soroka. That's a hospital in Be'er Sheva." He said, our son, who is an officer in the IDF, was in the battle down at the South, and he was wounded and evacuated to the hospital. But because the hospital is so full with other wounded and murdered people, they just told him to go back home. And once he got into his parents' car, he said, I have to talk to a psychologist. So they called me to see if there's anyone I can recommend. I said, are you joking? Come over. I have never met their son. They're good friends, but I didn't know their son. So at 12:45, my doorbell, they rang my doorbell and I went out of my house and I was shocked. Our friends, they were completely pale and they looked shocked. And then I saw behind them their son. He's 21 years old, very tall and handsome. He was wearing civilian clothes because they had to cut his uniform in the hospital. There were bandages all over him, stained with blood. And he was just, his eyes were completely glass. I mean, he didn't say a word. He looked really shell-shocked. And so we sat in my office for the next 2 hours, and he told me everything that he went through on October 7th, just a few hours before. Apparently, his very small base was invaded by, like, I think 100 terrorists, and they pushed the soldiers into the dining hall of the base, and there he stayed with his fellows for the next 7 hours or so. And I think basically maybe three times an hour, the terrorists just threw in a grenade or some explosives. So some of his friends were killed next to him. And they were all wounded. Everyone who survived was wounded. And I think it was about 3 o'clock that a special unit of one of the elite units of the IDF managed to enter the base and save them. I'm still treating him. For the next weeks, I had to see him at home because his PTSD gradually emerged and he was too afraid to leave his house. And PTSD has a lot to do with feeling guilty and ashamed and helpless. And he felt very guilty and very ashamed for the people around him who got killed and for not being able to do anything. My husband says I only have 3 moments, but I have like about 8 or more survivors, so I'll speak quicker. Maybe 5 or 6 days after October 7th. October 8th. Let's go back. October 8th, I get up in the morning and we get into the car and we go to the Dead Sea, to the hotels, to where the people were evacuated to. And we got there even as they were stepping down the buses, and it was like a scene from a movie. They were barefoot, most of them, wearing their pajamas, holding some teddy bears, the children. And they were just giving us name of people that were missing, asking us to try and look for them in the hospitals, or maybe they were dead. They had no idea what was going on. Many of the people still live in hotels. You know, their communities have been burned to the ground. They can't go back. And then I went back home, and I texted one of my friends, my colleagues, and we decided that we need psychoanalysts to treat the survivors because we need people who are experts in treating compound bereavement and trauma and who will be willing to be with them for as long as it takes. It may take years for these people to recover. So we texted our colleagues in the 3 psychoanalytic institutes in Israel, and within an hour we had more than 450 psychoanalysts, all volunteered to treat the survivors free of charge for however long it will take. We are still working with the survivors. 4 days following the massacre, I got a call from one of the social workers that I met at the Dead Sea hotels. It's really surreal that the people were evacuated to the Dead Sea. And she told me there's a young girl from the kibbutz, 19 years old, and she was just informed that her entire family had been murdered on October 7th. She's now in Tel Aviv. Could you please rush over and meet with her? Because she and her aunts have to make up their mind where they're going to bury the family. It was a big issue where to bury the one who were murdered because the kibbutzim were still under fire, so they had to choose either to bury them in the kibbutz without any audience or to bury them somewhere else in Israel and then remove the graves once it will be possible. So I went over and I met Shira. Shira was 19 years old. She was hiding in a shelter with her boyfriend at the kibbutz, and her parents and three siblings were locked up in another shelter in the same kibbutz. And they texted one another for the first few hours, just saying, I'm okay, I'm not okay. And in the kibbutz, which is a small community, they have a WhatsApp group for everyone. So everyone was reading the text of the people in the kibbutz, writing, I hear Arabic outside my window, they're knocking on the door, I can hear the gunshots. They're burning the house, I'm in it, what should I do? I'm suffocating, they've murdered my children. What? Okay, I think you're getting the point. And so they texted one another, and at 10:48 in the morning, her phone rang and she saw that it was her brother. So she picked up the phone. And of course, everyone had to keep quiet so the terrorists wouldn't find them. So she picked up the phone. She couldn't, there was no one on the other side, but she could hear some noises of banging on the door. She later found out that it was, of course, gunshots, not banging on the door. She then heard her mother and her sister scream in terror. And then it was completely silent. And she had no idea whether they were kidnapped or murdered, but about a week after the event, the police arrived and told her that all her family was identified. She's 20 now. She turned 20 in May. And she's all alone. There's no one. I mean, she has two aunts, but her entire family is gone. On November, I'm going back now, to October 7th. I don't know if you know, but Brothers and Sisters in Arms, which is one of the protest organizations, established a civilian war room to start searching for the people who were missing. They had about 1,000 people volunteering each day to go over the footage that the Hamas had broadcasted everywhere. And we were responsible to psychologically support these volunteers. So once the form of the families of the hostages was established, just 2 or 3 days after October 7th, they asked me to join and help. So I joined the form and I'm their mental health consultant. So in November, I was asked to support a family whose daughter is still in Gaza. Their young daughter is still in Gaza. And I'm treating her mother, which is a wonderful, smart, and a very gentle woman. I have to say that her mental health is going down the drain as time goes by, and especially after last week, which was very, very shocking to the families. And in November, once the government had the deal with the Hamas, and about 80 Israelis came back, all in all, I think it was 100, but 20 of the hostages were released were from other countries. Ever since November, I'm treating one of the young women who was in Gaza. She came back badly wounded. She's not out of the hospital yet. We are talking 9 months after her release and 11 months after the attack. And so I'm actually treating her by her bedside in the hospital because she's there. So I go back and forth to see her in the hospital. It's not the best setting, I have to tell you. And on the one hand, because I don't have any more time, I know I'm on the one hand, I feel that the Israeli society is very, very strong. We are not going to give up. whatever the fights are. But we have also become very, very, very sad. And there are days when every one of my patients, even those who have not survived the massacre, come in and just burst out crying. I mean, they can't hold it anymore. The combination of the war, the trauma, the fact that there are still missile attacks, and we don't exactly know where it's going to, and the fact that the political situation is so difficult makes it almost unbearable. I don't know if I'm lucky to work with so many people, and I have to be optimistic when I see them, or I'm not lucky because I have to hear all these horrible stories about how people are afraid for their lives. I think it's very clear to all of us, to most of us anyway, that the mental health situation is what is probably the most important issue, and that people are, I think most of the Israelis are traumatized, not suffering PTSD, but traumatized, profoundly sad, angry. They feel very betrayed. There are endless stories, the atrocities that the people had to witness, especially the people who were at the Nova Party, is like unimaginable. It's like really beyond imagination. And the first and major association that I think most of us have is, of course, the Holocaust.